Gustavo starts with a context which is certainly a familiar refrain, especially in Sefer Dvarim, telling us that we should observe all the mitzvot. And of course, this is one of the major themes of Sefer Dvarim, and telling us to be aware of and to keep all the mitzvot. So that's how the Iliya starts. V'itzav Moshe v'ziknei Yisrael sa'am le'mor shamor eskal ha-mitzvah asher anochi mitzava eslam hayom. And this phrase, hayom, also is going to be, this word, is going to be an important theme, which we'll come back to by the end of the Aliyah. But the first part of the Aliyah here talks about a fascinating instruction, which we don't necessarily understand so well, as we'll see. There's quite a lot of debate about just what it is that's being described in these next few psukim, but it involves some kind of big rocks, or some kind of at least very capacious rocks, rocks that can hold a lot, because this pasuk tells us, V'haya b'yom asher tavru es ha'yardein, el ha'aretz asher Hashem alokecha nosein loch, v'hakimoso locha avanim gidolos, v'sadatos on besid. So you shall cross over the Yardein to get into the land. What are you going to do? You're going to set up big rocks. Now, the role of these rocks and the identity of these rocks is itself an interesting discussion, which many chime in on, as you see. So there's quite a lot of debate, and it's already miraculous how much these rocks could possibly contain, as we'll see. So it'll be a miracle if we can contain all the shittas about what's on these rocks. It's quite a debate. So first of all, as far as the purpose, so there's not in the Torah notes that we find rocks described in Sefer Yeshua also, in Parak Dalet, in Parak Ches, and in Parak Dalet in Sefer Yeshua, the language is, V'odatam espenechem lemor ve'abasha avar Yisrael sayyadein hazeh. And here we have maybe two more rocks. So then the question is, what exactly is on all these rocks? And what exactly is the purpose of all these rocks? So the Netziv notes that one of these two rocks here is for the Jews, and one is for the Umos HaOlam. And that's something that we'll come back to, the role of these rocks, not just for the Jews, but for the nations of the world as well. Because Na'im L'Torah suggests that a part of the message here to the Umos HaOlam is to make clear that this is our land, that this land was given to us by God. And in that context, in that sense, it seems to be evocative of the first Rashi in Chumash. If you recall, the first Rashi in Chumash talks about why do we need the story of Bereishis, why is that important to our religious understanding. And there, Rashi says, because there'll come a time, right? Rashi writes 1,000 years ago, that there'll come a time when the Umos HaOlam will say, listim atem, when the nations of the world will say, you stole this land, it doesn't belong to you, and we need to establish that the same God who created the world can decide who lives where. So you would think that that would solve the whole issue. So why are they still fighting about this? Why is this still something that is at all in question? We just should just show up at the United Nations or to the New York Times and say, look, there's a Rashi and Chumash says like this. So the story is all over. So you don't think it's going to work?
I mean, no, it's just interesting because while the Christians and Muslims both believe that the Jews are part of the whole actual religious story, they're not denying the validity of Jews. They just kind of think they're the next.
Christians are supersessionists.
Yeah. The Muslims don't believe that too, are they?
It's as if they have a different track.
Didn't the Pope come out and say that might not be the case anymore?
So there's definitely different strands. What he's referring to has to do with the belief that the Jewish people were overtaken. But the idea that this should be the end of the discussion, it does seem to be a little bit overly ambitious. Right? Why is there still anything to talk about, especially now? It's related to this Aliyah also. So you have Art Scroll, you have translations, so we'll just point to it in English. And so what's the problem?
There are Christians who do believe we should be in Israel. Like, they're like,
correct.
So the Rashi does actually have, people have actually abided by the logic of Rashi.
For some it works. But it seems also, as the Bali Musar point out, that really it's for us. That it's not necessarily going to convince anybody any more than any other pasuk in Chumash that we could point to. But it's crucial for us that we should know that we have a legitimate claim and that it is ethical and appropriate and just. And halavai, the rest of the world will catch up. But until they do, so we have to at least know that what we are working off of is a valid and appropriate and moral position. And perhaps in that sense, maybe this is the continuation of that. So once we internalize that message, so then we can also broadcast it, we can also send it out. And perhaps that's what this next step represents, that we are meant to set up these big signs, these big rocks, and to make this message. So what is the message? So this next pasuk is one where really there is quite a lot to try to figure out. And the pasuk says, "V'chasavto alehen es kol divrei haTorah hazos va'avrocha l'man asher tovo el haaretz asher Hashem elokecha nosein lacha eretz avaschla b'devash kasher diber Hashem elokei avusach alav." So, writing on this, kol divrei haTorah hazos. So, what does that mean? So, some say it means you should write all the mitzvot down. And the Ramban says it means exactly what it sounds like, which is the entire Torah from the beginning to the end. Not only that, but with all the tagin, with all the symbols on it, and that's where they would copy the Sefer Torah from, to know where the tagin should be. Every single part of it should be up there. So that's pretty impressive.
Would that include like Parat Epsukim?
Okay, so let's say either way.
Or even Hazin.
Right, that's Epsukim. So it's good to point out that that's a kashin, the Ramban Shita, that why we would stop here, you know, so then the rest of the Torah is still to come. The last day Psukim have their own whole issue to figure out, as the Gemara says, and maybe we'll have a chance to talk about that a little bit before Simchas Torah. I guess two different questions. So should the last day Psukim be treated differently? And also, should the fact that there's more of Dvarim between here and there, how should that play a role? So that's a part of why there are these different opinions, because that's one of the kashas that's raised against the Ramban, but there's also the Smitsius issue, so getting the whole Torah on these rocks seems pretty impressive. So the Ramban has two possible explanations to that. He says, Yitochen, it's possible they were very big rocks. So they were really big. Or that it's a Maisenisim, that it's a miracle. So that which was theoretically impossible was taking place anyway. They were able to get the whole Torah on these rocks. The Torah Tamima and others, they assert that it's not really shaykh, that it could be the whole Torah. So maybe it means the Asara said Dibros, in which case it would make it look like a lot of shuls, right? So in a lot of shuls, they have big rocks up in the front that have Asara said Dibros on them, or even just the beginnings of each of the Dibros in order to get the message across. So maybe that's what we're talking about. Let's see for a question about that.
No, it's a good way to build the first opinion.
Yeah,
it's a little bit. It's a little bit of a side point, but about all the mitzvahs.
Mm-hmm.
So, meaning, how many? What?
Oh, so that's a question also. So that's
I mean, Rosh Chodesh didn't exist yet.
Right, the language of Sundas Farim is Misbar Mitzvos, which is also a little vague.
Right.
And the Parsis V'Chodesh, he suggests that this view about the mitzvos, which is attributed, among others, to Rapsadjagon, the Ben Ezra quotes it from Rapsadjagon. So he thinks that what he means is specifically the Asara Sadibros, like the Torah Tumim was suggesting. And for Rapsadjagon, that would be the Shitaso, because some of the Rishonim had an approach, the Ramban also wrote an essay about this, that the question is always present, what is the significance of the Asara Sadibros? If we have 613 mitzvos, so what do the Asara Sadibros have special about them? And in fact, the whole English translation of calling it the Ten Commandments is a little problematic, because it's a lot problematic because we have 613 commandments. So what's the idea of 10? It is quite misleading, as the Gemara says, that was a concern of putting the Asara Sadibros into davening to create a misleading impression. So some of the Rishonim have an approach here that the Asara Sadibros is kind of an outline of the entire Torah, and that you can fit the entire Torah into these 10 principles, or not you can fit it all, but you can have it all derived from these 10 principles. So the Ramban spells that out in an essay, and Rapsadjagon understood that way also. So maybe that's what he means. When he says the mitzvos, he means the Asara Sadibros. And we know from all the shuls that that is feasible, and that that is certainly a popular way of conveying the message of the Torah in some kind of visual and accessible form. Others of the Sforno, hi.
Hi. isn't the fact that it's in an Aron Kodesh enough? Meaning, like, the fact that it's surrounded
that
by...
That the Torah is in the
right.
In the shuls, the Torah is in the Aron Kodesh. But here we're talking about setting up these big rocks by the entry, you know, by the mountain. So it doesn't...
Saying, but we apply the Torah to shuls nowadays, and we said that Allah has the Aser HaDibro.
Yeah, so why shuls have what they have?
Is it's like shtick.
Shtick, but, you know, they have different ways of conveying their message. Right? We feel it's a little bit more formal than that. But...
nice shtick.
Right, okay, that's the one way to put it. But the idea that this is our key message and mission and the essence of life, another way to put it, is a part of the decisions that the shuls make when they make their designs. But here, you don't have the actual Aron presence. You have some other way of trying to convey it. So this is among the opinions. There are a few others also. So the Sforno understands that it's the Parshas HaMelech. It's read at Hakel. We have Hakel coming up at the end of the Shemitah year, so it's a little timely. The Meiri, in his commentary to Sota on Daf Lamed Beis, where there's a couple of references that we'll mention in a moment. The Gemara in Sota talks about this whole section of the Torah. So the Meiri suggests it's a reference to Mishneh Torah, to that special retelling of the Torah that we spoke about a little bit, the topic of our first Tosfos and our Masechta, the special status of Dvarim and Mishneh Torah. So maybe that's what we mean, that should be up there. The Ralbag, in his commentary to Sefer Yoshua, he thought that maybe it was a reference to the Brachos and the Klalos, and that... if you want to say it's the size of the Mizbeach, which is a little unclear, because the next pasuk talks about building the Mizbeach, so are we saying that there's a relationship between the Mizbeach and the stones? So if it was like a Mizbeach, like Bayis Sheni says, so then it wouldn't necessarily be so daunting to put the whole Torah. But otherwise, maybe it's something shorter, like the Brachos and the Kuelos. But even if you could fit the entire Torah onto some kind of big Mizbeach thing, and of course now there's all kinds of different abilities to squeeze text. You've seen the lithographs, you've seen these paintings where they put large amounts of text into a small space, and maybe it's theoretically possible, like an Apple Watch. So, still, it gets even bigger because, any question about that?
Oh, I saw when we went to the Israel Museum, they were able to put Tanakh on like a very small nano piece.
Right. So is that what we're talking about, and is that helpful at all if no one's able to read it? So, but on the lithographs you could actually make it out. So that's part of the question. So as the Aznaim Torah notes, that the Gemara in Sota, which referenced the Lamed Beis, does understand the language of the pasuk that tells us Be'er Heitev. Right, if we keep reading, so let's go down to Pasuk Ches, where it says again, Chosavta al Habonim es kol divrei HaTorah Hazos, Ba'er Heitev, should explain everything very well, and it's such a resonant phrase, it was the title of at least two commentaries to the Shulchan Aruch, the Ba'er Heitev. So to explain it well, the Gemara says the Sota, that means to translate it into all the languages, into all the 70 languages for the nations of the world. So then you really have to say that it's a Maisa Nisim, like the Ramban considered, because then you're really pushing it. One thing, but the whole Torah times 70, we're really getting quite extreme. You can't even just click and have it switch to a different page. So that would really be pretty impressive. And the Aznaim Torah, the Litzkarav, suggests that maybe the miraculousness of it is the point, that we want to, again, if we want to make this as consistent with what he said before, that we want to establish that we have the divine license, that we have a Kadosh Baruch Hu's Haskama, so to have this miraculous presentation that no one else could pull off, maybe that's a part of it. The Torah Tanina assumes that 70 isn't necessarily a reference to all the 70 languages, but that it's part of the idea of Shum Panam LaTorah, you should say all the Pshatim, which I don't know if that makes it easier to fit in, it's a different way to... different way to have a lot of content to put in there. But the idea of translating it for the Umos, making it available for the Umos, however we understand that, is itself a crucial idea here, that this wasn't just for the Jews, but this was apparently to make the message resonate with the rest of the world. And Rav Shamshon Afal Hirsch in his commentary here writes that the people of Israel's language was the people of Israel were to know from the outset that their mission was to help bring about the moral and spiritual salvation of all mankind. So to understand that they have a mission for the world and that that's supposed to be conveyed through them to everyone else, that was a part of the imagery here, and that's a part of what we're trying to evoke.
Yeah, it's a synergy with the Gemara, because it's about Tikkun Olam.
So so what Tikkun Olam means is going to be...
Right, well, that's the Gemara.
Yeah, but we'll take the synergy. Well, anything for synergy, we'll take it.
Yeah.
But speaking of synergy, sort of, so I recall that about 8 years ago, the one time I had the opportunity to introduce to a crowd Rabbi Jonathan Sachs, Zichrono Livracha, he spoke here at Kol Yom Rishon, and I had the opportunity to introduce him, and it was Parshas Kisavo then, or it was right after Parshas Kisavo, so I made reference to this idea that he represents this notion that Rav Hirsch is interpreting from the message on the rocks, that their mission of the Jewish people is to help bring about the moral and spiritual salvation of all mankind, and that Rabbi Sachs had made that his mission, that he was so outstanding at doing that, so much so that now I guess a little bit of timeliness also, that the new king, I think the new king now, King Charles, had said about Rabbi Sachs that he was a light unto that nation and Britain because of his recognition of this mission. So this is what Hirsch is saying, is the symbolism of having the rocks translated, so he was able to use that at that time. It was Parshas Kisavo then, right after Parshas Kisavo, to introduce Rabbi Sachs and to make that point. Regarding that point, the Sefer Ksava HaKabbalah, so he uses that to reflect on the other question, the question we've been dealing with before, of what was actually on the rocks. So because it's there to convey a message to everyone, so the Ksav HaKabbalah says that's a proof that it's not going to be all the mitzvos, because not all the mitzvos are relevant to all of humanity. And he thought it was Shman V'Hayam Shemoah, which is the theme of Yichud HaBorei, of there being one God in control of everything. So he understands that therefore that must be what was put there to be transmitted to the whole world. Just as far as all of the complicated positions here, then again, it's hard enough to even say all the positions and fit that into one rock. So there is a sefer called Otzer Plos HaTorah, which, as the title indicates, contains many pleiadic things, many wondrous things, and they just came out with a volume on Dvarim. The other four were out for a while, just came out with a volume on Dvarim. So he has a pleiadic thing talking about this. He quotes from the Sefer Sifsei Kohen al HaTorah that the language of Gedolos that we have here at the beginning of the big rocks, so it's chaser at the beginning. The vav, the first vav, is not spelled out. It's just a dot. So he says that's to convey that the way they transported these rocks, that would be pretty difficult to transport these big rocks, so they were made small while they were carrying them. And then once they got there, they became big again. So it's a miracle. It's the pleiadic. So it's appropriate for that sefer about the pleiadic Torah. That's definitely pleiadic, and that's a part of the range of perspectives here to understand what was going on. Eric?
So this isn't a fully formed idea yet. It's like, just hear me out.
Those are the most interesting.
Yeah. So nowadays we have things a lot smaller than big rocks that can contain a lot of information. And I don't know exactly. I can't think of exactly how it might work back then. And that still probably go according to the miracle approach. We even have, you know, stories that we don't even know. The Ur Metum was a special type of collection of, I don't want to say rocks, but, you know, different stones and stuff like that. And it had powers that conveyed messages a lot more than the 12 symbols that had on there. I don't know exactly how to phrase it, but is it possible we're dealing with a technology that's we could compare it to like a smartphone nowadays, where or a computer where, like, it maybe contained all the information of the Torah, and the ability to access it was some sort of special, I don't know.
Well, anything's possible. See, that's the thing. So we see some understanding it as being miraculous, like the Ramban is considering a few others, and maybe there's specifically innate components here. And then even if we work off that framework, so then it's still a question, which I think Caleb was alluding to perhaps, is the question of, so what do we want to do with this miracle? So does this also have to be legible? Does it also have to be that the people can access it? If, let's say, theoretically, or actually, as we know, certainly now we do have the technology to make things much smaller than that and to fit endless text in a very small place. But the question is, how does it get accessed and how much does that matter? So is this meant to convey some kind of a symbolic message, or is the reading it also miraculous? Or is it actually about being able to read the text, and in which case, how much does that have to factor in? So we see all of these different opinions, this whole range, they're all revolving around some of these questions. So essentially, it's all possible. But the Torah also says, v'sadato son basid, you should cover them up with plaster, and according to Rabbi Yehuda in the Gemara and Sota and Daf Amid Hei, means they first wrote them and then covered them with the plaster, to protect them, apparently, to protect the writing. So this role of covering it up is interesting because it sounds like when you write something on top of something else, it's normally called the Gemara, actually, in Gittin, we'll talk about this, it's a little synergy on that front, that's considered to be an act of mechika, that's erasing what you're covering up. So that would be a problem here. We're going to erase this content of the Torah. So there's a discussion about this in Poskim because they want to know what to derive from here as far as other things that may constitute erasing. So, for example, the Tshuvas Panim Meiros has a discussion about a shul setting that had old plaques that had tefillos that were written up on the wall with Shem Hashem, and they wanted to put other things over it. So could you plaster over it and right on top of that, would that be an act of mechika? So he assumes from here, he quotes this as a raya, that that's not called mechika because it can be uncovered. And there's a similar statement in the Tshuva of Akiva Eiger, where he talks about you have wax that falls on a Sefer Torah, so it covers up a letter, let's say, when it falls. So is that like a Sefer Torah that's missing a letter? Is that going to be a puzzle? So he assumes that, no, it's not. And that therefore, to also bring a raya from here, of course, it would be better to clean off the Sefer Torah and take off the wax, but it wouldn't necessarily create a soul at the time that it's there. There's also a discussion of Tshuvas Miltzdaka where he suggests that when the Gemara says that you are covering something up, when you write on top of it, that's when it's ksav, when it's just written on parchment. But here the letters are carved into the stone, so they don't disappear when something else is put on top of it. So there's a difference between that which is carved and that which is written. So perhaps that's a part of it. There's also the question of if this is like the Mizbeach, which is a part of what's not 100% clear from the Pesukim here, but so then in the Mizbech, you couldn't carve with steel. You had to use the Shamir. So is that what we're talking about? So the Malbim has a discussion about that and assumes that it wasn't the same as the Mizbech, but that's also something that we have to figure out. So here in the language, the Pasuk, which tells us to put up these stones, so we should set them up on Har Ebal. So here, as the Zayin Torah notes, that's an interesting location. That's really right in the heart of the enemy territory, to say to put it there. So he suggests a couple of answers. He says one is to show that we're not Stam conquerors who are just coming to take over, but we're here on this mission. And also because that's where Avram went, so we want to show that this is a fulfillment of the Havtacha to him. And also for the Jews, that they should know that this is the role to come to the land to fulfill the mitzvah, so the mitzvahs should be stated there. Rav Moshe Feinstein, in his Darash Moshe, so he notes something also interesting about it being Har Ebal specifically. What does Har Ebal represent? It seems to represent the Klalos, right? That's the mountain where the Klalos were issued from. So he suggests, I'll be Darach Hadrush, that the difference between Bracha and Klalos is not just good and bad, but the Bracha represents Ribui, that you have excess, and Klalos represents a feeling of lack, of deficiency. And he suggests that's a part of the message here, that we should feel like there's always more to do, it's never enough, and that therefore that's the imagery here of the Kalala, so to speak, not in the sense of bad, but in the sense of they should feel like there's more. So now to go past this, in Pasuk Zayin, it said, V'zavachta shlamim v'achalta sham, v'samachta l'fnei Hashem elokecha. So Gemara says here, Gemara says in Pesachim, on Daf Kuftes and Aleph, that you see from here that B'zman Hazeh, there's Ein Simcha Ela Basir, and that afterwards we need wine from the Pasuk in Tehillim. So as the Torah Tamima comments, because you hear the Zvicha would refer to the Basir, so the Torah Tamima interprets the Gemara to be making the point that this all ties into Kedusha, the Basar V'ayin, the Basar, and therefore without this we need the wine in order to make that more appreciated and understood. So here we have that pasuk again, V'chasavta ala avonim eschadavir aterazos berhetev. And then, now to get to the end of the Aliyah, so there's an unusual word here, the pasuk test, the language is V'yedavir Moshe v'akohanim halevi'im, El kol Yisrael le'mor haskei sushma Yisrael hayom hazeh niyeh salam la'Hashem elokecha. That you should appreciate that you are God's people today. It refers to the covenant. But what is this language, haskeis? What does that mean? So the English translations, they translate it as heed, pay attention. But it's an unusual word. And the word only appears once. It only appears as one time. And the Gemara, in the end of Brachos, and Samach Gimel and Mubeis, has a number of drashos on this, and the Torah Shmimi writes, he thinks all the drashos are because there is something clearly unusual about this language. The word only appears once. So, exactly, that word also doesn't appear too many times. So, you have to figure out exactly what it's coming to say. So, the Gemara had a couple of drashos. Among the drashos in the Gemara is that you should make kitos, haskes means groups, that Torah is only acquired in a chabura, that you can't succeed in learning when you are alone and isolated. Also, that you should kill yourself over the learning, which is a striking term, and it's evocative of the drasha that Chazal have regarding the Parah Adumah, and regarding that whole section of the Torah in Parshas Chukas, where it says, Zos Chukas HaTorah, Odom Ki Yomus Ba'ohel, and the Chazal have the language, Ein Divrei Torah Miskaimim, that Torah endures when somebody makes himself dead over it, which does not mean, God forbid, to actually die. You know, we say b'chai b'hem, but it means, as the way many explain, that you are so committed to the Torah that the whole rest of the world, it's ke'ilu, it's not around. It's ke'ilu, it's not existing, it's all dead to you. You are so absorbed and focused. And that's what is considered to be the message, perhaps. And then the last drush of the Gemara has is that haskes means you should think about it after you first take in the information. We have to learn the facts. And then, once you know the facts, once you understand it, once you understand the basics, once you're aware of the basics, so then you can ponder and you can try to consider what its message is and how it all comes to tell you something that is a function of the whole. So to be able to first learn and then ponder, which there are a number of Gemaras throughout Shas that have that general message. And that's another possibility that the Gemara is understanding here. So the language of Hayom Hazeh, which we have here in this Pasuk, Hayom Hazeh Niyeh Sula'am, and the last pasuk continues to say, "V'shamata b'kol shmolkecha v'asisa etz mosot tzvosav v'yeskukav asher anochi mitzavecha hayom." So you have hayom also, but this idea first, "V'shamata b'kol." So that's an important phrase, that to listen to God in His specific directions really would be "shamata l'kol." You should listen to the instructions. "V'shamata b'kol." So that could be a reference to the notion of Torah Shebaal Peh. The Shem Yishmuel has a phrase like this. The Shem Yishmuel understands, others have this kind of understanding as well, that the whole notion of Chazal, who made extra mitzvos and who told us what to do on a level midrabanan, is because they were able to pay very close attention to what is in the Torah and to understand what could be supplementary to that, that is also Baratzon Hashem, what will also be consistent with the intent that God is transmitting, the notion of Ratzon HaTorah. So the Shem Shmuel, I think others have this idea as well, that the Torah doesn't just say we should listen to the direction, Shema Tolikol, but Bikol, you should try to understand what's in the voice, try to understand what the message is, try to interpret what the broader picture is, and therefore that gives us all of the values of the Torah that are not only the explicit rules. So the idea that Chazal made additional rules because they were able to understand, where Rav Schechter sometimes phrases it, those who know how to read the lines very well, they know how to read between the lines, they know how to understand the message that's being conveyed. That's the Bishamat Bikol. Did you?
Just applied to like chukim necessarily, or just like chukim you can understand, it's like, oh, you're just doing it because you're committed to Hashem.
So chukim certainly have that challenge that we're not able to fully or even partially really understand what they're getting at, so it becomes much harder, which is why the Nitziv writes in his commentary on Chumash that when you have a prohibition of Baal Tosef, says Baal Tosef is really only about the chukim, because we don't understand what they're about, so we can only do exactly what it says. But when it comes to the Mishpatim, so then we are able to have some sense of what the message is. So then we have this concept of Lefnim Meshur Sadin, and it's not a problem with Baal Tosef. We try to understand more what to do with it. Rabbeinu Yonah has a comment in the beginning of his commentary to Pirkei Avos, where he says that the Mishnah's phrase there, having Mesunim B'din, says it means that we should think carefully about principles of din, about principles of mishpat, because there we can understand the Kadosh Baruch Hu's message most powerfully, because we have some ability, we think we do at least, to figure out what the themes are in the Shlatim. So if we pay close attention to God's words specifically in the context of the Mishpatim, so we'll have greater potential to try to understand it and to apply it. And that's why the Mishnah says to pay special attention to this, a fascinating idea. So all of this certainly has more applicability in those areas, the more we're able to, at least on any level, kind of understand what it's about, so the more we're able to do with it. So there is such a distinction that probably does make sense.
Is it problematic? I mean, I would not say this is the reason, but is it problematic to, brainstorm reasons behind it?
No, we still want to try, because that's an important, we spoke about that a little bit last week, I think, that it's still the distinction between a chok and a mishpat is not so absolute, because it's just a function of our perception. But we certainly assume that everything in the Torah has a purpose. We don't necessarily understand it. So every chok really has aspects of mishpat, and every mishpat also has things we don't understand, even if it seems to be very rational and very accessible, but it has rules that are beyond us, or that also speaks to things that go much further than we appreciate. So every mishpat has elements of chok, and every chok has elements of mishpat. So we don't have an absolute distinction between them. It just goes to our perception. But we do want to try very hard to try to understand what even a chok is telling us, and that's what the Sefer HaChinuch and the Rambam, when they wrote about their interpretations of mitzvot, they tried to work with the chukim also, even though it's challenging. So, but the idea that we should try to figure out what the Ratzon HaTorah is, and to work with that, so that's an idea that you find in many places, and some connected to this kind of language of Shamat Vikol. Some point out also that you have a parallel, if not mistaken, Parshas told us. So the Torah has a phrase about Avram Avinu, Ekev Asher Shama Bikoli, that's the language there, that Avram was able to figure out what the Ratzon HaBore was because he paid close attention, Bikol, to listen what's the message behind the call. And that's the reason the Gemara says, Numa, based on that pasuk, that the Avos kept the Torah before it was given, meaning that even without a tzivoy, they were able to intuit what the will of God was because they paid very close attention to what they could experience from the voice of God, and to try to understand it and to try to listen out for the deeper messages. That's what they were doing, and that prompted them to voluntarily fulfill the whole Torah before it was given. And on our level, where the Torah is commanded, But the notion that there's still more to do, that Chazal figured out what the Dinim Drabbanan were, that was also going to be a function of the same kind of attitude of listening, bikol, of trying to hear not just the words, but also what is the message that's behind it. So that's also a part of what the Pasuk is telling us, but this repetition of Yom here, that we have Sharnachim itself, the Hayom, and Hayom Hazaz, it seems from the very beginning of the Aliyah, we start with talking about Hayom, Yom comes out throughout. So the Gemara also has a drasha, also there in Brachos, that the, you should love the Torah every day, Kiyom Shemitna Mehar Sinai, that just like the enthusiasm and the excitement for the Torah on the day it was given, so we should have that enthusiasm every day. And then the Gemara also has a line which seems to be going in a different direction, and apparently that somebody who misses Kriya Shema, even though he says Kriya Shema every day, in the morning and in the night, and then one day doesn't say it, it's as if he didn't say it ever. So what do those ideas have to do with each other? So there's a nice essay about this in the Sefer Shari Ora, Shari Ora of Rav Meir Tzvi Bergman, who's a son-in-law of Rav Shach. He often quotes from Rav Shach. So he understands that the point here, he says, how could you be excited for the Torah as if it was the day it was given, when it's now so familiar, we spent so many years learning the Torah, how do you maintain that excitement every day as if it's totally new? So he notes that really it is totally new to us, because there's always more to discern and to learn. And the nature of the Torah is that it's all quality. So there's nothing there that's just repetition. So quantity has no impact. So even if you've been learning for your whole life, and we've been learning collectively for millennia, but there's always more for us to uncover, and therefore we're always able to feel that newness. So when the Gemara makes that point about Kriya Shema, it's a way of saying that just because you've said Kriya Shema so many thousands of times in your life, so it doesn't get you off the hook for missing it now, because it's not given to quantity. It's everything is its own unique experience. And however many times you say Kriya Shema before now, it doesn't cover up for the fact that this is a missed opportunity here. And that's something which has its own message to it. The Taz, in his commentary to Shulchan Aruch in Mem Zayin, so he notes that when the Berachos HaTorah, so we have what seems like a shift in tense, because we say Asher Nosen Lanu Torah Semes, and we say Kadosh Baruch Hu is Nosen HaTorah, that he gave us the Torah, and also that he is the present tense giver of the Torah. And he says that reflects this reality that the Torah has been with us for a long time, but we are to feel like it's always happening now, feel like there is a constant re-giving of the Torah, and that's what we are supposed to try to internalize. So Rav Neventhal has a drasha on this Aliyah, has a sicha on this Aliyah, where he notes that this whole description of what we just read about today, or what we will read about that we talked about today, that the whole procedure here seems to really evoke Matan Torah. It seems to really reflect this idea that Matan Torah is a renewing experience. So here we have the writing down of the Torah, we have the korbanos that are brought. It seems like it's about a new Maimon Har Sinai. It seems like that's kind of the imagery here of re-evoking Maimon Har Sinai. So why is it necessary to have some kind of a level of recreation of Maimon Har Sinai? So it has a few suggestions. So one suggestion is it's a new generation, so they need their own Maimon Har Sinai-like experience. Or also that as you're going into Eretz Yisrael, so it's on a whole different level, and therefore it really needs a new encounter with the receiving of the Torah, like those who raise the question that its mitzvos are on a higher level in Eretz Yisrael, is a comment to the Ramban that requires a little bit of understanding. So maybe if you fly now and you could get to Eretz Yisrael on the same day as you leave, so maybe a mitzvah that you already did that day, maybe you should do again, because it's now on a higher level. So it's an interesting question, but it does perhaps match with this notion that as they're about to enter into Eretz Yisrael, so they need the Torah given to them again in order to prepare them for this new experience, which was also functionally different. They're not going to be given everything anymore. They're not going to be living in the Midbar with the supernatural, overtly supernatural, and evidently providential care. They're going to have to be functioning at a different level, and maybe that's a part of it. You could probably add also that if that is the message, so one major difference between this and Matan Torah is the Jews have to do all the work here in order to write down the message themselves. And maybe that's a part of what we're trying to convey. That this is now the proper stage, that after they've been given the Torah, now their turn is to write it down themselves and to broadcast that message and to make sure that it's something they have incorporated into their perspectives and are now able to convey and to transmit in a new sense. So this whole idea that there needs to be a constant renewal, especially at a new stage, there needs to be a re-engaging with the mission and taking it over on a new level. So that's where all of us are at right now. We are now anticipating Rosh Hashanah, New Year, and the process of tshuva that comes along with that is a effort to try to reconnect with who we can be and how we can take everything from the previous years and use that to move forward to a new level, to a new madrega. And that brings us to the fact that we are now on the eve, essentially, or almost on the eve of the recitation of Slichos. So just to say a few words about that, as indicated that we would. So the notion of Slichos is described in the Gemara in Rosh Hashanah, where the Gemara tells us that following the whole tragic episode of the Egel Hazav, when Moshe Rabbeinu entreated God to forgive the Jewish people, and he was successful. So the Psukim tell us, and the Gemara interprets the Psukim, that the Yud Gimel Midos HaRachamim were conveyed to Moshe Rabbeinu at that time. And Yud Gimel Midos are the core of the Slichos recitation. It's really about reciting the format of Tefillah. That's how some point out, or Slavetchik pointed out in his Shirim, that we have the format of Tefillah that is the framework for Slichos. So we have a Chazan, and we have an Ashrei, and we have the whole structure that looks like a Tefillah structure, with a Tachnam. It's all evocative of what we associate with tefillah, but the core of it is the Yud Gimel Midos HaRachamim, this special recitation which requires a minyan, at least to recite it as a tefillah requires a minyan, so we try to get a minyan for Slichos for that purpose, so that we can say the Yud Gimel Midos HaRachamim in that context. And the Gemara says that the Kadosh Baruch Hu at that time, in the aftermath of the Egel Azav, that he was Nesatef Betalis, Ke Shliach Tzibur, that he acted like a Shliach Tzibur, and he wrapped himself in a talis kaviyachal, and he taught Yud Gimel Midos HaRachamim. And that he said to Moshe Rabbeinu, you should tell the Jews that whenever they are in trouble spiritually, Yeyesu Lefanai Kiseder Hazos, so they should do in front of me like this. So sounds like, on a Pashtus level, it means that they should recite the Yud Gimel Midos. So the notion of that being the core of the Slichos experience, this recitation, which we work into a number of times in the typical Slichos day, is a reflection of the fact that the Gemara tells us that at that most difficult moment in Jewish history, right after the Egel Azav, and the time when Tshuva was such a necessary and crucial component of what was going on, the Jews had to be redeemed from this terrible recent transgression. So this process of reciting the Yud Gimel Midos HaRachamim is vital, but as some understand also that the language of Yesu Lefanai, they should do in front of me like this, it doesn't just mean to recite, maybe it doesn't mean at all to recite, but it means that we should act with chesed, that we should try to understand that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is chesed, and that we are told the halachta b'drachah. That's also one of the meta themes of Sefer Dvarim, to come back to what Sefer Dvarim is about. So the Chafetz Chaim notes that you find 8 times in Sefer Dvarim alone some format of the idea of a halachta bedrachav, that we are meant to follow in God's path. And of course, that's a difficult order. We don't have the same skill set. How do we imitate God? How do we follow in His path? So the Gemara says a number of times that it's about engaging in chesed. And the Gemara has it 2 different ways. Sometimes throughout the Shas, you find different statements like this. Sometimes it refers to the midos, that we should have the attributes of a Kaddish Baruch Hu. Mahu racham v'chanen, avata racham v'chanen, we should be kind and compassionate like He is. And sometimes it focuses on actions. Mahu kover mesim, umal b'sharumim, avata kover mesim, umal b'sharumim. It's just like God engages in chesed, actual forms and activities. So too, that's what we're supposed to do. But one way or another, so we understand that the Midas HaRachamim represent the message of HaKadosh Baruch Hu to us, and that therefore, if we're told that we should try to do the Seder, Yeresu Lefanai, in order to bring about a kapara, so yes, it could mean reciting it, but it also should mean that we should try to work on these midos, that we should try to internalize the attributes of Rachamim through this time. And of course, that is vital for us to be forgiven for anything, because we know Chazal tell us that if we want to be the recipient of a Kadosh Baruch Hu's Rachman, so we have to be people who relate to a system of Rachmanas and a system of being Dam L'Chavsos. So we have to have that attitude towards the people who we encounter. And by making ourselves appreciate that value system, so then it's reasonable to ask that a Kadosh Baruch Hu should treat us the same way. So that's a big part of this process of the Yigim Biras HaRachamim and the recitation and the Korah of Slichos. And so we have this practice, Klal Yisrael has this mimic, that in anticipation of the din of Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, so we make sure to have these recitations on a frequent basis at a time that is meant to evoke Ratzon, and that itself is a complicated, somewhat mystical idea, that we have such a focus on the time, that it should be specifically at night after Chatzos. It shouldn't be before Chatzos, because it's not a time that is conducive. So it's the idea is very difficult to understand, except to the extent that what it's getting at is that this is all about Valachta Bedrachah. This is all about trying to tap in to HaKadosh Baruch Hu's Rachmanis, and therefore to stick to the format that's described in Parshas Kisisa, and to also follow the rhythms that are described in terms of one is a time of Rachman and one is a time of Din, and to see that that is a part of what we're trying to evoke. That's why the Poskim seem to take that component very significantly. So all of that is what Slichos represents to us. But here we're talking about this today because our plan as Ashkenazim is to start saying Slichos on Motzei Shabbos. So the Sfardim have been saying Slichos from Rosh Chodesh. It's a pretty intense 40 days. And the Shulchan Aruch records that practice. That's what it says in Shulchan Aruch, that you should start saying these Tchinos, Me'ashmaras HaBoker, in the middle of the night, you should start saying this from Rosh Chodesh Elul. And then the Ramah adds that by the Ashkenazim, so we don't do this from Rosh Chodesh Elul, we blow the shofar from Rosh Chodesh Elul. We got something the Ramah says that we're doing from Rosh Chodesh Elul. But as far as Slichos, so the practice among the Ashkenazim is to take 2 metrics and put them together to come up with a time. So what are the 2 metrics that we use to figure out when we start Slichos? So one is that by the Ashkenazim, it's always a Motzoi Shabbos. We start always on a Saturday night. Say Motzoi Menucha, Kidamnucha Tchila, that we express our supplication at the time when Menucha of Shabbos is still on our mind, is still a part of what we have recently experienced, and we are kind of segueing directly from that holiness, that Kedusha of Shabbos, into this process of Slichos. So that's one metric, that we want to keep it on this opening note, that everything that Shabbos represents to us should be brought with to our Slichos experience. And even though we're going to have many nights of Slichos afterwards, But it's all going to be defined by that opening slichos that sets the tone. Eric?
Why do we do it till late at night?
So that's what we were referencing before, that the notion is somewhat mystical, that there is a time that is more mesubel for rachamim as opposed to a time that is considered to be a harsher time of din. This idea, it's hard for us to relate to. We talked before about chukim. I think in our kind of rationalist thinking, it's hard for us to really connect to, but that is something that the post can take very seriously and do assume that is an important part of how we're assessing things. And that's what we're suggesting, that maybe it's because this is about the halakha b'drachav, so whatever we have an understanding of how Kadosh Baruch Hu is creating a rhythm, so we want to plug into that rhythm and not work against it. But of course, even with that explanation, it is beyond us. That's something that's very hard for us to relate to. But that's not one of the two metrics that I was referring to. So one metric is that it should be on a Mosai Shabbos. So if that was the only concern, so then let's start next Mosai Shabbos, because we still have another Motzi Shabbos before Rosh Hashanah. So why are we doing it this Motzi Shabbos? So the other metric is that it should be at least 4 days of that before Rosh Hashanah. So if Rosh Hashanah is too early in the week, as it is this year, so then we're not going to be able to do both, to have 4 days on a Motzi Shabbos if we start next Motzi Shabbos. So we said we start this Motzi Shabbos so that we get both. We get the Motzi Shabbos lunch, and also there's at least 4 days, and that'll be more than a whole week, before Rosh Hashanah actually starts. So what's the significance of 4 days? So there are various suggestions. Some suggest that it has to do with the korbanos and the notion of bikur, that we would set aside the korbanos beforehand to make sure that they are perfectly appropriate. So too, we're doing that with ourselves, that before we actually begin Rosh Hashanah, we're going through an introspective process for at least 4 days before Rosh Hashanah. That's one possibility. The other possibility is very striking and something to really think about, and that is that the Aseret Yimei Tshuva, so we would want that we could theoretically be fasting for all of the Aseret Yimei Tshuva. But there, you wouldn't want that, so it doesn't sound so appealing, but spiritually it's appealing, even if it seems quite daunting. But luckily or unlucky, we can't fast for the entire Aseret Yimei Tshuva, because there are at least 4 days, there are 4 days that are not fastable, that fall out during the Aseret Yimei Tshuva. So what are the 4 days? So we have a Shabbos always, and every 10-day period you're going to have a Shabbos, and you can't fast on Shabbos. Erev Yom Kippur, there is a mitzvah to eat, so we're not allowed to fast on Erev Yom Kippur. And 2 days Rosh Hashanah. So that's coming from the assumption that you're not allowed to fast on Rosh Hashanah. It's a big machlokas Rishon. There's actually quite a few views about that.
The Rav fast?
So on Rosh Hashanah itself, maybe
no,
Erev Rosh Hashanah, maybe Erev Rosh Hashanah. But on Rosh Hashanah itself, the truth is machlokas Rishonim about whether you can fast or not, and it's a different sugya. Maybe we'll have time to talk about it, but as you can guess, what's the right answer to every question, right? Are you allowed to fast on Rosh Hashanah? What's the right answer? It's machlokas, right? So you think you're safe because it's machlokas. Do you think there's two opinions? There's actually 6 opinions on this question of whether you can fast on Rosh Hashanah. So it's yes, no, it's a good idea. You can fast half a day, you can fast the second day, only special tzaddikim can fast. So at least 6 opinions as to what is the answer to that question. But here, this explanation is assuming that you're not going to fast on Rosh Hashanah. So if you subtract from the Aseret Yimei Tshuva, you take out 2 days Rosh Hashanah and Erev Yom Kippur and Shabbos, so that leaves you with only 6 days. So 4 days you can't fast. So some suggest that because we're missing 4 days, so we start earlier in order to get 4 extra days, and that's where we get this practice of starting 4 days before Rosh Hashanah at least, and then to get a Motzi Shabbos, that brings us to this point. So there are many fascinating things that you can glean just from that concept. So first of all, as Soloveitchik pointed out, that you see here that the Aseret Yimei Tshuva is not just happenstance. It's not just, well, okay, so we want to chop a rind and do tshuva between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, so that's 10 days, so we get the Aseret Yimei Tshuva. No, apparently not. Apparently there's a notion of 10 days of tshuva. And if we can't get them all in between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, because some of them have to be subtracted, so then we should start earlier in order to get a full Aser Shemei Tshuva. So that's a very fascinating idea, that there is a notion of Aser Shemei Tshuva. And also, then that puts a whole different perspective on what's going on here, that it's not only there's a recitation that's taking place during these days, but we are transforming them into the annex, into the expansion of the Aser Shemei Tshuva. Aser Shemei Tshuva essentially starts with the beginning of Slichos, that we're extending the process back then to Slichos towards Yom Kippur. And that's our new and expanded Aser Shemei Tshuva. So that's itself a fascinating idea to ponder. Did you?
So people who like take on like Chomer the Pas Yisrael, Chomer Yisrael, something like that, like, is that also during the week of Slichos before the Aser Shemei Tshuva?
I don't know that people necessarily do that. It's kedai to take on Chumash during Aser Shemei Tshuva, but we normally assume that it's actually from Rosh Hashanah to Yom Kippur. But it's still something to ponder, so actually to kind of put a little twist on that. So you remember that this whole explanation is based on figuring out how to fast for the whole 10 days. And because we have 4 days that you can't fast, so we had to expand it. But I don't think, I'm not going to put anybody on the spot, but I don't think that too many of us are planning on fasting for all of the Aser Shemei Tshuva, even the remaining days. Now, we actually are planning on fasting for two of them, which is pretty good for a random 10-day sample. But still, the rest of the days, I don't think most of us actually are fasting. So what happens to this whole idea? So the truth is, it's still very relevant to us, because the point of fasting during the Aser Shemei Tshuva, I think this is also according to those Rishonim would say you can or should fast on Rosh Hashanah itself. The fasting is never the end goal. The fasting is not what it's about. The fasting is a means to an end. The fasting is a way to try to provoke a sense of internal tshuva, because we are motivated to recognize that something is different. And therefore, for us, it may or may not be fasting. Fasting is not always the best idea for everyone. Shulchan Aruch says that for guys in yeshiva or Talmidei Chachamim, to take on extra fasts is maybe counterproductive, because they'll become weaker and they won't be able to learn as well. So what? Maybe it's not necessarily fasting, but it's to recognize that the fasting is a means to an end. The fasting is a way to try to put one in the mindset of tshuva and to trigger a change in behavior. And that's something that we each can do for ourselves. We have to really go through a process of trying to figure out, so what kind of a context can I create for myself throughout this tikufa, the Aser Shemei Tshuva certainly, even the extended Aser Shemei Tshuva, so that the environment will be conducive to tshuva, to growth, to, you know, those of you who were zochet to hear Marco in the Beis Medrash, who said that the point was that he was inspired to grow because of his connection with the Talmidim and Rebbeim, the Sishiva. So that's the message, right? We want to try to figure out what is it that stimulates growth, that pushes us to try to develop and to become more than we are. So for some it will be fasting, for some it will be something else, for some it will be creating actively a context that pushes you to think that way and to develop that way. And that's what the Aser Shemei Tshuva and the expanded Aser Shemei Tshuva is meant to bring about for us. So whether or not we're fasting the whole time, but Eric asked, why is it so late at night? It is true that we're certainly at least sleep deprived the whole time, right? So we are tired and don't necessarily want to be more tired than we can handle, but it does symbolize a certain notion of being knocked out of your routine. And perhaps that's also a very valuable feeling. So as much as it's important to be well-rested and healthy throughout this tikufa as well, but to whatever extent, inevitably, we're a little bit tired, so we can reflect upon this idea that it means we've been pushed out of our routine, that our normal habits are not able to continue throughout this time. And that's really what the tikufa, Aser Shemei Tshuva, and the Slichos days is meant to evoke from us that something is different and that we can't just follow routine, we have to shake things up. So that act of shaking things up is what allows things to be rebuilt in a better way. And just like there's a new need for inspiration as we enter into the land and the stones have to have the Torah written and maybe in the sense of a new Kabbalah Torah, because as you take on this new phase, so there has to be a recommitment and a rebuilding. So too, as we look towards the new year, so we need to shake up that routine, we need to move out of habit and to move to a place of deliberate choice. And hopefully being pushed out of our comfort zone, literally out of our comfort zone, is something that allows us to reflect and to rebuild and to recreate and to renew. And with all of that, we can hope for a happier future. We can hope for a year of bracha, and that's also one of the messages of Rosh Hashanah, to have the appropriate yira, but also to be balanced with the appropriate confidence in the process. And that there is a simcha that comes from that, that comes from knowing that you're doing everything you can to try to actualize the promise of Rosh Hashanah. So as we head towards this beginning of the Sichus process, as we listen to HaKadosh Baruch Hu's Midos repeated again and again, and we recognize that this is the message to us to become people who have taken the Midos of HaKadosh Baruch Hu and worked to emulate them, worked to build upon them, and to develop them as a key defining feature of who we are, we should indeed be zocha, and that the Sichus process should help us undertake a willing transformation and a big step forward towards a year when we are more perfect versions of what we hope to be for ourselves. So I wish you all a wonderful Shabbos Menucha and a wonderful Motzoi Menucha, and God willing, on Sunday we'll pick a time and we will start with some new topics. All right.